You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. In the online world, it can feel like privacy is a lost cause. Technology companies find out a lot about us. Everything from our health data to dating sites to private messages with romantic partners aren't entirely our own. And there's a growing problem with non-consensual pornography, our most private moments being captured and used for extortion, humiliation, and abuse. Our next guest says we have yet to grasp the scale of that invasion of our intimate privacy and that U.S. law is failing to protect it. She calls for elevating that privacy as a fundamental right and turning to civil rights law as a way to give us back control over our own information. Danielle Citrin is a distinguished professor of law at the University of Virginia, where she teaches about privacy, free expression, and civil rights. She's director of the university's Law Tech Center. Her latest book is called The Fight for Privacy, Protecting Dignity, Identity, and Love in the Digital Age. I talked to her earlier this fall. The book centers around this concept of intimate privacy. What do you mean by that?
So it's the privacy. It's information and access to our bodies, our health, our innermost thoughts, which of course we don't realize, but we document all day long on our, you know, our reading, our browsing, our searching, all of our digital communications, and then our closest relationships.
We, I think, sometimes accept a loss of privacy as the price of entry into the online world. Does it have to be that way?
It doesn't have to be, and it shouldn't be. You know, we, you know, go to the restroom and use hotel, you know, bedrooms and bathrooms, and we kind of all the while we expect and we deserve privacy around our, you know, our bodies and our, you know, our physical selves. And the same is true when we, you know, use search engines to figure out medicines that we want to take, or we look and we read on WebMD about our health conditions. At the same time, we are expecting privacy and we deserve privacy, but so often we don't get it.
You just mentioned a couple of the main categories you focus on in your book. I want to start with that second one, the information that gets accumulated on us when we use reward points at a pharmacy or do a medical search or participate in a dating site. You talk about when people go and get information that's collected by these data companies we haven't heard of. Can you talk about how extensive a dossier exists, probably about each and every one of us at this point?
Oh, yeah. So I would say that most, there are about 10,000 data brokers, and about 98% of all Americans have dossiers held by these companies, and they have over 10,000 data points on each and every one of us. Now, you might say to me, like, how is that possible? I'm not that interesting. But what is, you know, everything that we do and all the traces of our online lives, whether it's the, you know, our activities on our dating and our health apps, our searches, our location, where we're going, tells us a story about, you know, we're ranked and rated and scored. Have we ever been a rape victim? Have we ever had terminated pregnancy, had a miscarriage? Have we ever had, you know, high blood pressure? What's our risk of getting a chronic disease, like, let's say, type 1 diabetes or type 2 diabetes? And so data brokers have data points that suggest so many different aspects of our lives, our sexual orientation, our deepest interests, whether we're sex toy users, how often we use adult sites. The list goes on and on. I'm just trying to give some, sure, you know, some examples, right, of just how invasive, how much of a story data broker dossiers tell about us in ways that we would never kind of expect and in ways that we have no control over.
Okay, now we worry sometimes about a data breach, right? All that stuff falling into the wrong hands illegally. Set that aside. Who are the customers for this data? What are people legally doing with these massive troves of data about all of us?
Some of the biggest clients of data brokers are law enforcement. So state, federal, and local law enforcement. Using it to detect all crimes, all hazards, and all risks. And of course, not just law enforcement, but employers, life insurance companies, hiring services. There are third-party hiring services that detect, you know, that sort of run their algorithms through vast databases of resumes. Those hiring services, so not the employers themselves, are making recommendations to employers about the people to hire. So it's, you know, you name the industry, besides advertisers and marketers, they're buying those data broker dossiers.
What kind of legal changes would you like to see, or maybe changes in the way companies do business that give us, I don't know, more say, more control over where all that data gets used?
So I want to move us away from the notion that sort of control is the answer, and for us to understand intimate information in our intimate lives as implicating, you know, a moral right, a fundamental human right and civil right, which would mean that rather than kind of leaving it up to individuals and consumers to make choices, which at scale we really can't do, it's really hard with, you know, the 10,000 data brokers are just the tip of the iceberg of the extent to which our information is being collected, you know, used and sold. And so if we understood intimate privacy as a civil right, that would sort of, right now our presumption is that you can collect anything you want, you can share it, and you can use it so long as you have some warning in your privacy policy that, frankly, no one reads, you know, in the bottom of your web page. I'd like us to flip that presumption. If we understood our intimate data as implicating our civil rights, that is the rights that all of us enjoy and have important structural protections against discrimination, what that would mean is that when a powerful entity has power over our civil rights, it means that that entity is understood as the caretaker of those rights. They are the stewards of those rights. And so you can't, if you understand intimate privacy as implicating our civil rights, it would mean that anyone, individuals, companies, governments, interacting with our intimate information would have to be the guardians of that data. And some of the time that would mean you can't collect it. You can't collect, you know, if you're a data guardian, if you don't strictly need data, you need a darn good reason to implicate and to undermine intimate privacy. So if you don't have a good reason to collect data, then you just shouldn't collect it. And it would also mean a civil right to intimate privacy would also mean that the guardians, so individuals, companies, governments, would have to treat that data with a duty of loyalty to us and care and with protections against discrimination.
We're listening back to a conversation with Danielle Citron, professor of law at the University of Virginia, author of the book, The Fight for Privacy, Protecting Dignity, Identity, and Love in the Digital Age. We'll hear more of that conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're listening back to a talk with University of Virginia law professor Danielle Citron about her book, The Fight for Privacy, Protecting Dignity, Identity, and Love in the Digital Age. Here's the rest of that conversation. Danielle, another big focus of the book is on non-consensual pornography. It is a shorthand that covers a lot of ground. Can you talk about what that is and how prevalent it is?
Sure. So the non-consensual invasions of our intimate privacy can cover things like non-consensual taping someone in the bedroom or bathroom. It can cover extorting nude images from someone, sort of threatening to release your intimate images. Upskirt, down blouse photos, so taking a photo up your skirt without your permission. It can include the non-consensual disclosure of intimate information, often, as you said, well, you know, described as non-consensual pornography. It's sort of the best shorthand term we have for it. And in all of those ways, and many others, one's intimate images or intimate life is being invaded and violated without their permission. And when that information, often their, you know, intimate images are posted online, it can be really difficult to both get and keep a job. Your peace of mind is shot, your sense of safety. When, you know, your nude images are posted online, you often sort of think of yourself as being kind of, people see you as just a fragment of yourself. You know, you're just your genitals, you're just your, you know, breasts. And it can be really hard to have that sense of safety and security back.
And you talk to people who have been victims of various kinds of things you just mentioned. And one problem seems to be law enforcement and the law, in large part, really haven't kept up with this and offer not a lot of options to someone who's a victim.
That's right. So, you know, folks go, so I interviewed 60 people from the United States, mostly the United Kingdom, Iceland, India, and Australia. And I have to say, our response or lack of response in the United States, they're the same problems across the globe. And unfortunately, very similar sort of failure to respond from law enforcement across the globe. And it is kind of a combination of lack of training with regard to laws and the fact that so many, to the extent that law covers non-consensual intimate, you know, abusive intimate images, it's a misdemeanor. And it's just not worth law enforcement's time to do anything about it. And then you might think, okay, well, what about the platforms? You know, they're going to respond either to, you know, to lawsuits and pressure. but they're immune from responsibility thanks to Section 230 of the Decency Act. So it's victims often say to me and have said to me, they just feel like so unprotected because they turn to law enforcement and they're told nothing can be done. They even consider suing their attackers to the extent that they know who they are, and they don't have money to sue. And most lawyers aren't, you know, don't provide low bono or pro bono services for this kind of work. And there's no deep pocket. And so it's really difficult to get a lawyer to represent you on a contingency basis. You know, they would if there's a deep pocket, but not here. You know, platforms are totally immune from responsibility for the most part. And so there are 9,500 sites whose raison d'etre is intimate image abuse. And, you know, they make money from the collection of data and advertising and some subscription services. Like, they have very uncreative names like Hidden Cam and Hidden Camera or Mr. Deepfakes. And they make money off, you know, out of exploiting people's intimate, you know, the most intimate moments and exploiting them.
You share one success story in the book, getting search engines to not point toward searches toward those sites you just mentioned. Can you talk about how that happened?
Yes. It's, you know, whenever you write about something that has great frustration for most people who undergo intimate privacy violations, there are some bright stories. So I worked with then Attorney General Kamala Harris. In 2015, she put together a cyber exploitation task force. And she gathered companies together. You know, she was in Silicon Valley. And so 50 companies came together to meet to talk about the exploitation of people's nude images without their consent. And so often the complaint to AG Harris and to me was, we want these images out of searches in our names. And at the time at this meeting, you know, Google was saying, listen, we don't touch our search engine. We will, there's nothing we're going to do to our algorithms to address this problem. And after the work of the task force and Google joining that effort along with Microsoft, so Microsoft Bing, in about 6 months after, you know, as we were doing our work, Google and Bing announced, as well as Yahoo, that they would de-index non-consensual intimate image and images in searches of people's names. Now, the images would still remain online. They'd still be on those, you know, vile sites devoted to intimate image abuse. But it wouldn't be in a search of their name so that, you know, future dates, future employers, friends, you know, so often people Google you before they ever meet you. And so it was such a relief to victims to have some sense that at least they could minimize some of the damage.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Danielle, that is one of a handful of examples where you say it's worth people fighting to make these changes because they do happen.
That's right. I mean, we have seen progress, not only with regards to law enforcers like when AG Harris, but also we've seen legislative promise in countries like South Korea, sort of wholesale reform of their laws and support for victims. So I have to say, I know I can be a bit of a Pollyanna, but I'm not giving up hope. I think, you know, if together we can pressure companies to bring our sort of moral suasion to bear, and we can work on lawmakers to make a difference.
Danielle, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Danielle Citrin is a professor of law at the University of Virginia. We listen back to a conversation about our newest book. It's called The Fight for Privacy: Protecting Dignity, Identity, and Love in the Digital Age. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. More than 1,400 deaths in Wisconsin last year were related to opioid drugs. That's up 16% from 2020, up 56% from 2019. Our next guest says Good Samaritan laws can help save lives in the opioid epidemic by giving some protection to people who call 911 in the event of an overdose. But she says to have the biggest impact, Wisconsin's Good Samaritan law needs to be strengthened. Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury Afshar specializes in treatment for opioid addiction at UW Health. She's part of the Wisconsin Good Samaritan Coalition, which is pushing for changes to the state's law. Dr. Salisbury Afshar, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
People may run into Good Samaritan laws in different contexts. What do we mean by Good Samaritan laws when it's related in particular to opioid overdoses?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I will definitely jump in. I think that the first thing I want to say, though, is that opioid overdose deaths are preventable, mm-hmm. and they're preventable when people can get timely naloxone administration and medical care in the event that they are experiencing an overdose. And so Good Samaritan laws were really created. The first one was passed in the United States in 2007 with a key goal in mind, and that key goal is that we want people to feel safe in getting help for a friend or a loved one, or even, you know, could even be someone they don't know, that if they call 911, that they themselves have legal protections, that they won't be prosecuted or arrested because they're in the same, you know, space as someone who's using drugs. Some states have even gone further to include protections for the person who's experiencing the overdose, again, to protect them from having legal repercussions if they do survive the overdose.
Let's talk about that a little more. In that situation, say I'm in the room with a person who's overdosed. If the goal is to save the person's life, you don't want me hesitating and worrying because I'm worried that, well, I also use those medications, or am I going to get this person arrested? We're trying to overcome that reluctance to get that care that needs to happen on a very strict timetable, right?
Absolutely. And so, unfortunately, what we see so often, and I will just say, both in Wisconsin and in several other states, I have had the duty to review overdose fatality cases. So after people have died, going back through the medical examiner case, and it's very common that we see that there were other individuals at the scene where the overdose was happening, but people get scared. It could be that they were also using substances. It could be that they are on probation or parole. It could be that maybe a loved one is in my house using substances, even though I didn't know and had nothing to do with it. I'm really afraid to call 911 because at that point the police could come and I don't know what's going to happen. And I don't feel confident that, you know, I will be protected legally. The other thing that we know happens frequently, unfortunately, in Wisconsin, and unfortunately, I don't have data. I would just say anecdotally, I meet patients and families for whom this has happened, is that the individual who survives the overdose then goes on to be arrested and be charged. And the arrest, you know, we know that incarceration is not a quote unquote treatment for addiction. In fact, it actually causes additional harms, causes additional trauma, can increase the risk for future overdose. And then if they are charged and they have felony charges, those charges stay with people for life. It makes it harder for them to get jobs. It makes it harder for them to get housing. So it's actually causing additional harms when someone is arrested and incarcerated solely for experiencing and surviving an overdose. And we unfortunately know that that happens fairly commonly. So this makes, you know, bystanders, family, friends, people feel really nervous. Do I want to call? Not only what could happen to me, but is something bad going to happen to the person that I'm trying to help?
As you mentioned, different states may have different versions of these Good Samaritan laws. I want to dig into the fine points. What specifically does Wisconsin's current Good Samaritan law protect?
Yeah, so it's a little confusing because our original law was passed in 2013 as part of the HOPE legislation. And this provided some pretty limited immunities for the person who calls 911. Then in 2017, we added some additional protections. We added additional protections for the person who called 911. We also added protections for the person who survives the overdose. But interestingly, that 2017 amendment had what's called a sunset clause. And it said, you know, these amendments exist from July of 2017 until July of 2020. And if this clause isn't removed by July of 2020, then everything gets sort of wiped clean and we go back to our original 2013 legislation. Folks can probably remember what was happening in the summer of 2020. We were in the midst of a pandemic. You know, there were all kinds of shutdowns and, you know, lots of crises that were trying to be averted. And unfortunately, that sunset clause was not removed. So we went back to the very limited 2013 legislation that really provides some super limited protections for the person who calls. It provides no parole or probation revocation protections, and it provides no protections at all for the person who survives an overdose. I will say this is particularly concerning because available research that's tried to look at what is the efficacy of these laws has found that specifically, you know, that there are all kinds of laws across all of the states. This group, Hamilton et al., it was published in 2021 in the International Journal of Drug Policy. They said, okay, if we look at the stronger laws, which they defined as laws that provide immunity from arrest, compared to the weaker laws, which they defined as sort of everything else, basically not immunity from arrest. What they found is that the laws that offered arrest protections led to a 10% reduction in overdose death. The states that didn't have those arrest protections didn't see any statistically significant reduction in death. So the Wisconsin law offers no arrest protections. So I think that's one important thing to acknowledge. The other important thing to acknowledge is just that even if some of these laws aren't necessarily able to be shown to prevent death, I know from working with patients with addiction on a daily basis that the negative repercussions of being arrested and having these charges follow them for the rest of their lives when their sole offense was really experiencing an overdose and getting medical care stays with people, and it makes it so much harder for people to be able to enter recovery. And so this is, again, what sort of causes a lot of anxiety and reservation around folks feeling confident in calling for help.
We're talking to Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury Afshar, who treats opioid addiction at UW Health and a part of the Wisconsin Good Samaritan Coalition looking for changes in Wisconsin law. Dr. Salisbury Afshar, what are you hoping lawmakers and the governor get together and do to change the law here in Wisconsin?
So I think at a high level, our main goal is that we want to expand protections so that if someone is around a loved one, a family member, a friend who is experiencing an overdose, they feel confident that they can call 911 and get that person help, and that there won't be negative legal repercussions solely for calling 911 and solely for helping that person get medical attention. My goal would be that they would expand to arrest protections. That is my personal goal. I'm not speaking on behalf of other entities, but just because we know based on the current literature and evidence that they're most likely to reduce mortality. I also would advocate that any individual who survives an overdose should be linked to supportive services, not incarcerated and charged because they survived an overdose. And to be clear, the charges are technically around typically possession or paraphernalia that's at the scene. But the only reason that these individuals are sort of caught, if you will, is because they needed medical attention. And our end goal is that we want people to get medical attention. We want people to get the services that they need. We know that people with addiction get better when they get the services that they need. And we want to create a circumstance where people can get that.
And as you mentioned, you work with patients dealing with addiction. What kind of stories have you heard from different people, maybe different communities in Wisconsin that you think highlight the need for stronger Good Samaritan laws?
So I think, you know, at the patient level, there's just a lot of concern and in many ways mistrust about what's going to happen if I try to get help, right? Who's going to be involved in the response? Is it going to be the police? Are we going to get hassled? Even if I'm not doing anything wrong, but let's say maybe I am on probation and I'm with someone who has an overdose, am I going to go back to jail for calling for help? Those are stories I hear on a regular basis. I also meet lots of patients who end up being arrested and charged because there was a small amount of drugs at the scene when they experienced their overdose. And then very sadly, I also meet families who have lost children to overdose and are left wondering, you know, were they with someone when they died? Did someone leave them out of concern for their own, you know, legal situation? And so when we look at the totality of what's happening, when we recognize that we're losing almost 4 people every day to overdose in the state of Wisconsin, you know, something has to change. Something has to give. We need to do things differently. We need to be more supportive in our approaches and really base our approaches in currently available evidence.
And we've talked on the show a lot about synthetic opioids, fentanyl and other related compounds showing up in the drug supply, often where people don't expect them. They're not labeled. Do you see that raising the stakes for Good Samaritan laws, given the likelihood of overdose from those drugs unexpectedly showing up?
Absolutely. So I think the variability in the drug market is what you're referencing. Mm-hmm. And while people in the past may have purchased a pill that they thought they knew what it was, we're seeing more and more cross-contamination or purposeful contamination. It's not always clear, which is putting people at increased risk. And so absolutely, we want to make sure that, again, everyone feels confident that when they call for medical help, they get medical help, not, you know, criminal legal intervention.
And as we wrap up, Dr. Salisbury Afshar, hopefully we do get the person the treatment they need after an overdose. What are your hopes for next steps, helping them get in a situation where they're not at that risk anymore, getting them treatment that might help them beat the addiction?
That's a great question. I think, you know, it's not a single response. It's going to likely require that we come at this from all angles, from the public health lens, definitely the emergency department where many folks end up. There's an expansion of something called peer recovery support services. And so making sure that we do have an opportunity to offer supportive outreach in linkage to services that people want and need. And there are lots of ways to get to that. And so I appreciate you asking the question. We are seeing some forward movement, but there's always room for improvement.
Dr. Salisbury-Afshar, thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much.
That's Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury-Afshar. She specializes in opioid addiction treatment at UW Health. She's part of a coalition pushing for changes to the state's Good Samaritan law that she says could save lives in the opioid epidemic.